The Fall of Margaret Thatcher, a whodunit. I recently published Herself Alone, the final volume of my authorised biography of Margaret Thatcher. When writing the chapter about Mrs. Thatcher's fall from office, I realised that the story is half tragedy, half whodunit. As in Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express, many of those involved had a motive. What follows is an attempt to convey this. I shall introduce the suspects and other dramatis personae as we proceed. The narrative is based on my book and draws on quotations from those interviewed and from the private papers and diaries which many of them kept at the time. None of the dialogue, therefore, is made up. The story is voiced by me and by Kate Ehrman, who assisted me with all three volumes of the book. First, let me remind you of the main characters. There is Mrs. Thatcher, of course, Prime Minister since 1979. Now, in November 1990, she is 65 years old. After winning three consecutive general elections, she has been 11 and a half years in office. Next comes her husband, Dennis, 11 years her senior. Though ever loyal, he had advised her 18 months earlier on her 10th anniversary in office that she should retire. She had ignored him. Sir Geoffrey Howe was her most senior cabinet minister. Chancellor of the Exchequer from 1979 to 1983, he had been her foreign secretary from then until July 1989, when she had demoted him to leader of the House of Commons. He felt very bitter about this and deeply disapproved of her views on Europe. Her most prominent rival was Michael Heseltine. After resigning from Mrs. Thatcher's government over the Westland scandal at the beginning of 1986, which highlighted their divisions over Europe, Heseltine had devoted his vast energies on the backbenches to trying to succeed her. Her foreign secretary at this time was Douglas Hurd, a patrician Tory at the pro-European centre of the government's high command. Her Chancellor of the Exchequer, John Major, aged only 47, was a rising star of the younger generation. Although widely seen, including sometimes by her, as Mrs. Thatcher's blue-eyed boy, he too was strongly pro-European and a Thatcherite in little more than name. I should also mention the head of state, Her Majesty the Queen, whose eighth Prime Minister Mrs. Thatcher was. It was to the Queen that Mrs. Thatcher would have to tender her resignation. The main events that Kate and I are narrating take place over a period of three very intense days in November 1990, which led to Mrs. Thatcher's fall. But to get an idea of how things were brewing, we must briefly recall that the year before, in November 1989, Sir Anthony Mayer had challenged Mrs. Thatcher for the leadership. An obscure backbencher, he was known as the Stalking Horse because he was hoping to replace her with Michael Heseltine. Mrs. Thatcher easily defeated Mayer, but the Stalking Horse challenge presented a real danger for her because it was the first ever formal revolt against her leadership. Here I must introduce a character unknown to fame, but very influential behind the scenes at the top of the Tory party, Tristan Garrel-Jones. Garrel-Jones was the deputy chief whip and known by his many friends and many foes alike as a great plotter. Although on the left of the party and strongly opposed to Mrs. Thatcher over Europe, he had helped manage her campaign against the Mayor challenge. She duly won the contest by a very large majority, but Garrel-Jones was struck by the depth of discontent with Mrs. Thatcher he had encountered among colleagues before the vote. Immediately after the result, in early December 1989, he visited her in 10 Downing Street. He said to her, "You've won easily this time, but remember there are 100 assassins lurking in the bushes." Garrel-Jones analysed the situation much more frankly in a secret message to the chief whip, Tim Renton. Renton himself was a problem for Mrs. Thatcher because he had no experience as a whip and because she had reluctantly given him the job as a sop to his great friend, the disaffected Geoffrey Howe. Renton, too, was a strong pro-European. For Renton's eyes only, Garrel-Jones wrote as follows: "I believe this is the beginning of the end for Mrs. Thatcher. The job of the whip's office is to try to manage that end in a way that does not split the party. This means avoiding the daylight assassination of the Prime Minister by her enemies. Heseltine will run next year, so all the ingredients exist for a fight, unless..." What did Garrel-Jones mean by "unless..." I think he meant, unless we at the top of the government can manage the transition so that Mrs. Thatcher goes next year, but Heseltine does not succeed her, and she is replaced by one of our number. This obviously was not what Mrs. Thatcher wanted at all. A year later, the situation for Mrs. Thatcher was much worse. She was beset by the unpopularity of the poll tax and cabinet-level rows about Europe. On the 1st of November 1990, she made an angry statement in Parliament about the European summit in Rome, where she had found herself isolated. Expressing her opposition to European integration, she uttered the famous words,
"No, no, no."
This so upset Geoffrey Howe, who was the strongest pro-European in the cabinet, that he resigned. Howe's departure was probably deliberately timed to coincide with the only month in the year when the rules allowed a challenge to the leadership. There was renewed speculation that a challenger, Michael Heseltine, would now come forward. It was Howe's deadly resignation statement in the House on the 13th of November which lit the blue touch paper.
Michael Heseltine sat in the debate behind Howe. He later recalled,
"I heard Geoffrey's chilling words. The time has now come for others to consider their own response to the tragic conflict of loyalties with which I myself have wrestled for so long."
Heseltine knew at this point that he must stand. After Howe's statement, Mrs. Thatcher walked to her parliamentary office behind the Speaker's chair, accompanied by John Major.
"She was hurt. She was wounded. She was shaken. I think she realised it was self-inflicted. I'm a tactile person and reached across, taking both her hands in mine. She kept them there for a good deal of the conversation." Michael Heseltine formally announced his challenge the next day, the 14th of November. In those days, the only voters in a leadership contest were Conservative MPs. Mrs. Thatcher needed to win outright on the first ballot. If the contest dragged on to a second, she would be weakened and the loyalty of her cabinet colleagues would be strained. The first ballot was a high hurdle for her. She needed not a simple majority, but an additional 15% of those entitled to vote. That first ballot was set for Tuesday, the 20th of November, despite the fact that Mrs. Thatcher would be at a disadvantage. She would not be in London, but in Paris, attending a grand gathering of world leaders to mark the West's victory in the Cold War, in which she had played such a central part. In her absence from Westminster, the plotting began. And now I want to introduce Alan Clark. Clark was a junior defence minister and a maverick. The diaries which later made him famous give a unique and often irreverent version of events. He was a great admirer of Mrs. Thatcher. I asked him at the time whether he was in love with her. His reply was alarmingly characteristic. "I don't want actual penetration," he said, "just a massive snog."
Wednesday, the 14th of November. Alan Clark noticed a curious state of limbo in the House of Commons, which he considered damaging to Mrs. Thatcher's chances. Tristan Garrell Jones called Clark from his car and said he thought that he could find a way to keep Heseltine out.
"As long as it works,"
said Clark.
"It's got to fucking work,"
Garrell Jones affirmed. Saturday, the 17th of November. Garrell Jones rang Clark again. He said that Douglas Hurd, who would be in Paris with Mrs. Thatcher, and John Major, who would be at home near Huntingdon, recovering from an operation on two impacted wisdom teeth,
would speak to each other in that critical hour after the first ballot result on Tuesday and settle what should happen next.
Clark had a follow-up question.
"Look, all these arguments are being tossed around on the assumption that we have to go to a second ballot."
"That's right, baby. If there's any uncertainty, a group of us are to meet at Catherine Place after the 10 p.m. vote that Tuesday evening."
Catherine Place was Garrell Jones's own house. Plans were being laid to fulfil Garrell Jones's hopes of managing the end of Mrs. Thatcher in her absence.
Two most senior figures in all this, too senior to be seen attending the meeting, were Douglas Hurd and John Major. Both had hopes of beating Heseltine and succeeding Mrs. Thatcher. Both thought their chances improved if they worked together. As Major said, "We were friends more than we were rivals."
Monday, the 19th of November, in the House of Commons and in the absence of Mrs. Thatcher, Alan Clark was growing anxious.
"The savour of a Heseltine victory starts to pervade the crannies and cupboards and committee rooms. At the top of the ministerial staircase, I ran into Tristan Garrell Jones. He was bubbling with suppressed excitement. I don't think he wants Hezzy, as he spastically calls him, to win, but he's high on the whole thing. Tristan said, "Of course every member of the cabinet will vote for the Prime Minister in the first round." "Like hell they will," I said to him, hoping he'd deny it. "One cannot actually exclude the possibility that Heseltine will score more votes than her on the first ballot." "No, I'm afraid one can't." This was really chilling. Apocalypse.
Tuesday, the 20th of November.
Mrs. Thatcher waited for the result in the British Embassy in Paris with her closest aides. There were three of these. Charles Pole, whose job title of Foreign Affairs Private Secretary did not begin to do justice to his pervasive influence over her. Cynthia Crawford, always known as Crawfy, Mrs. Thatcher's long-term personal assistant, dresser and confidant. And finally, her Parliamentary Private Secretary, Peter Morrison, who came from a well-connected grandee family, but was by now failing in his job of keeping her in touch with the party in the House of Commons. Morrison was under strain because of accusations, unknown to the public, that he had tried to pick up teenage youths. As a result, he was drinking very heavily.
Pole, Crawfy and Morrison were with Mrs. Thatcher, who was sitting at the dressing table in Morrison's bedroom in the British Embassy. The results came through from the chief whip. It was 204 votes for Mrs. Thatcher, 152 for Heseltine, and 16 abstentions. Mrs. Thatcher had just missed the threshold for victory on the first ballot. There would have to be a second. Out of Mrs. Thatcher's line of sight, Pole made a thumbs-down sign to Crawfy, but then he realised that Mrs. Thatcher had spotted him in her mirror.
"She could see my grimace. I'm sure she knew it was over."
Mrs. Thatcher descended quickly to the courtyard of the embassy, where the BBC was waiting. "I can confirm that it is my intention to let my name go forward for the second ballot."
She was now late for the banquet and ballet at Versailles, but President Mitterrand of France ensured that the occasion would not begin without her.
On the hurried car journey to Versailles, Peter Morrison recalled that
"her right arm leapt out and grabbed just above my left knee, and she dug her nails in quite painfully. And all she kept saying was,
'We must fight on. We must fight on. There's so much to do.'"
Back in Westminster, the air was thick with conspiracy. As MPs gathered in the Commons for the division that evening, John McGregor, the leader of the House, was sitting in his room just yards from the chamber.
"I became aware there were people outside who were clearly plotting. Tristan Garrel-Jones was one of the main ones."
Garrel-Jones started to round up a few selected colleagues and told Alan Clark, as he had mentioned on the phone the previous Saturday.
"We're meeting at my house straight after this."
"Who's we?"
asked Clark.
"Oh, just a few mates, Chris Patton and people." Chris Patton was perhaps the most charismatic of the rising generation of Tory ministers. Decidedly on the left of the party, he was another fervent pro-European.
Garrel-Jones went on.
"We need to talk through the next steps."
"How do you mean?"
asked Clark.
"Ways of supporting the Prime Minister,"
was how he put it.
At Catherine Place, those present were unanimous, except for Clark, that Mrs. Thatcher must go before the second ballot. Five were cabinet ministers of the generation below her. The question was who should stop Heseltine and succeed her. Almost all those attending supported either Douglas Hurd or John Major. Although Major denied that any campaign for him was in progress, Norman Lamont, the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, was already its manager. The meeting decided that the best way to reduce Heseltine's vote in the second ballot was for both Hurd and Major to stand. Then the more successful of the two might ultimately win, and each would see the other's supporters right.
The five cabinet ministers duly went to Parliament from Catherine Place to report their conclusions to Tim Renton, the Chief Whip.
With Renton was Alistair Goodlad, the Deputy Chief Whip, who had replaced Garrel-Jones when he had moved on that summer to become Minister for Europe. Another strong pro-European and an experienced behind-the-scenes manager, Goodlad was from the anti-Thatcher wing of the party.
Goodlad noted their view that
"the Prime Minister probably would not win, and even if she did, that she could not carry on. When asked by the Chief Whip if they were prepared to give the Prime Minister the same message direct, they demurred, amid some foot-shuffling."
At the banquet in Versailles, Mrs. Thatcher was fearful of the overwhelming attentions of the press as she left for Paris. Seeing that she was alone and without Dennis, President George Bush turned to his wife Barbara and said,
"There's Margaret. Maybe we should go with her."
She said to Bush, "Now don't worry, George. I'll go home and get this straight." In her memoirs, she described the gesture. This was one of those little acts of kindness which remind us that even power politics is not just about power. Returning to the British Embassy, Mrs. Thatcher retired to her room, but did not feel like sleep. She spent the night talking to Crawfee. The next morning, Crawfee did Mrs. Thatcher's hair and applied her makeup a little extra to her face, because everyone thinks you're going to be a sad little person. Wednesday, the 21st of November. At 8:20 in the morning, Tim Renton was surprised by the press as he scurried up and down Claiborne Mews, SW1. He was trying to find Willie Whitelaw's front door.
Willie Whitelaw, the grandest of the grandees, had until recently been Mrs. Thatcher's deputy and chief ambassador to those parts of the party she could not reach. He was now retired, but his influence with senior Tory MPs remained strong.
Once Renton had got inside, the two men discussed over breakfast what message he should convey from Whitelaw to Mrs. Thatcher. Whitelaw said there was
a danger of her being humiliated in the second ballot.
Even if she did not lose but won by a low margin, Whitelaw continued,
she will not be able to unite the party as the sniping will go on.
Whitelaw was happy for Renton to report this to her, but he refused to tell Mrs. Thatcher in person. The fact of the chief whip consulting the great tribal elder would make it obvious enough that Mrs. Thatcher was in deep trouble. The Whitelaw effect was swift. A colleague reported the view of a very young William Hague.
William Hague had shot to fame in the 1970s with a barnstorming speech at the party conference when aged only 16. Now he had recently entered Parliament in a by-election and was already PPS to Norman Lamont.
The colleague wrote,
Hague says that there is a massive withdrawal of support for the Prime Minister and that she will have to back down before the day is out as a result of pressure from people like Willie Whitelaw. Hague is getting geared up to organise the John Major campaign.
Earlier, at 8:30 that morning, Alistair Goodlad met John Wakeham by arrangement.
Wakeham, Mrs. Thatcher's former chief whip, was the great fixer of the age. Sidelined during the leadership battle because as energy secretary he was busy with electricity privatisation, he was now called back as a troubleshooter.
The good lads were old friends of Wakeham. They had cared for him as he recovered from the IRA's Brighton bomb, which had killed his first wife and severely injured him. Wakeham told Goodlad he
was sure the Prime Minister would go forward if she thought she could win.
But he had little to say about helping her to do so. Instead, he remarked that
there are only two ways of getting rid of a sitting Prime Minister. A vote of no confidence by the House of Commons or by the Cabinet.
So it was important for him and for her to know what Cabinet ministers thought. Wakeham was chatting to colleagues in his Commons ministerial room when Ken Clark entered.
Kenneth Clark, the new Education Secretary, was yet another of the rising pro-European generation of Cabinet ministers on the left of the party. He was not close to Mrs. Thatcher, but she admired his toughness as a minister.
Clark said,
she hasn't a chance, she's got to go.
In Paris, Mrs. Thatcher spent a politically unproductive morning at the signing ceremony of the conference. Alan Clark, trying to get through to warn her about the result of the Catherine Place meeting the night before, was blocked by Peter Morrison. Morrison.
There's a working breakfast.
Clark.
With a lot of fucking foreigners, I suppose.
Tristan Garrell-Jones, by contrast, reached his old school friend Charles Pole and gave him his version of the Catherine Place events.
Probably everyone in the room, except for Alan Clark, didn't vote for her in the first round.
Pole recalled,
Tristan wanted me to get the message to her that her position was now almost irretrievable. I passed it on to her.
Mrs. Thatcher flew back to London. She reached Downing Street at 11:50 and went straight up to her flat, where Dennis told her,
don't go on, love.
This had been his view for the previous 18 months. As always, Mrs. Thatcher appreciated his frankness, but I felt in my bones that I should fight on. At about this time, John Wakeham was publicly announced as her campaign manager. He did not even know that he had been offered the post.
He tried to get out of it, suggesting Kenneth Clark instead, though Clark was the most vehemently hostile to Mrs. Thatcher of all the cabinet. Ken Clark refused, so Wakeham was stuck with it. Wakeham then prepared her for what might come up, while her cabinet colleagues began to consult. His drift favoured Major as her successor, though he did not name him. The aim of saving Mrs. Thatcher was being nudged into something else, stopping Michael Heseltine. Wakeham argued that Mrs. Thatcher should see cabinet ministers individually to get their views. He thought that
a special cabinet meeting would not only leak, but would also be pretty chaotic. My clear impression,
Tim Renton recorded,
is that she intends to stand in the second ballot, as none of us have clearly and firmly told her that we do not think she has a chance of winning.
The men in suits had quailed before the woman with the handbag, as they had done for the past 11.5 years. Mrs. Thatcher left Downing Street to make her common statement on the Paris summit, and as she did so, she called out to the press the words, "I shall fight on, I fight to win." She returned to her room in the Commons at 4:45, where she was joined by Norman Tebbit, the fiercest of the leading Thatcherites.
Tebbit had promised his wife, who had been paralysed from the neck down in the Brighton bomb of 1984, in which he himself had been severely injured, that he should slow down, so he was now on the back benches.
Tebbit persuaded her to show her face fleetingly in the tea room to rally support. It was far too late. "I have never known an atmosphere like it in all my years in the House," she recalled. As she moved between tables, members told her that Heseltine had approached them 2 or 3 times for their vote, whereas she had not approached them at all. "Then I realised that many of these were supporters complaining that my campaign did not seem to be really fighting. We hadn't been around when there was a lot of nefarious activity." She now had no time to set this right, since she was due at Buckingham Palace at 5:30 for her weekly audience of the Queen. First, she returned to her room and saw Douglas Hurd formally asking him to re-nominate her. This he did at once. The deadline for the nominations was noon the following day. She was rushing for her palace appointment. She hastily telephoned the convalescent John Major at home. "I asked John to second my nomination." There was a moment's silence. The hesitation was palpable. No doubt the operation on John's wisdom teeth was giving him trouble. Then he said that if that was what I wanted, yes. John Major had been irritated by Mrs. Thatcher's call.
"She rang me peremptorily,"
he remembered.
"Rather breathless and abrupt."
"Douglas is going to re-nominate me and you will re-second me."
I was offended at the way she asked. I did think she had an obligation to have a discussion about tactics. Her call was an exact example why she got herself in such a situation.
He agreed, if reluctantly, to re-nominate.
Hand on heart, there was no hesitation from me because of manoeuvring.
It was not perhaps quite as simple as that. Though stuck nearly 70 miles away, Major was well informed of the events of the day. By that evening, he'd been told that he had 98 or 99 supporters signed by the campaign that supposedly did not exist. He had his friendly arrangement with Hurd. He knew how fast opinion was running against Mrs. Thatcher. He felt
it would be rather cowardly to shrink away from it.
If he re-nominated Mrs. Thatcher and she went forward to the second ballot, he would put himself out of the race. He had to solve this problem fast. Back in London, Alistair Goodlad was summoned by John Wakeham. He found him in his room,
sitting surrounded by cigar smoke, with Kenneth Baker, Tristan Garrow-Jones and Richard Ryder. Baker, the party chairman, saw it as his job to defend the leader. Richard Ryder, the former head of her political office and a shrewd behind-the-scenes operator, was in a unique position. Close though he was to Mrs. Thatcher, he was also a great friend of Geoffrey Howe. He could see the issue from both sides.
Wakeham had in his hand a list of cabinet ministers who had told him the Prime Minister should not go on. He said,
"She's living in cloud cuckoo land."
This was an extraordinary line for her campaign manager to be taking just as she was about to begin, at his suggestion, her individual meetings with cabinet ministers. Goodlad moved on to see Ken Clark and Patton. He asked them whether they were
resolved to take a robust line with the Prime Minister, and they said that they were.
The meetings with individual cabinet ministers began. But the first in was a rising junior minister, chosen perhaps because he was seen as a Thatcherite, Francis Maud. Maud said to her,
I'd rather be anywhere than this, but I think you're going to lose this election and Michael Heseltine is going to win, and that'd be a disaster.
Maud was already conscious before he entered Mrs. Thatcher's room of why Wakeham had proposed such meetings.
It was to get them individually to tell her it was over.
Mrs. Thatcher's response to Maud's words was, he thought,
magnificent. She was at her most fiery.
But it's a coup, she said. His answer, which he didn't give, would have been,
yes, but it's a successful one.
Next in was Kenneth Clark, who employed his characteristically genial brutality. He was dismayed that Wakeham had failed at lunchtime to persuade her to stand down. Clark said,
personally happy to support you for 5 to 10 more years. Most of the cabinet think you should stand down, as you're not only going to lose, but lose big. The party will go to Heseltine and be split. Douglas Hurd and John Major should be released from their obligation and allowed to stand. Either has a better chance than you.
He compared her campaign to the charge of the Light Brigade. He later wrote that Mrs. Thatcher was
calm and confident
and accused him of being defeatist. Clark passed on to other cabinet ministers what he had said to Mrs. Thatcher and
thereby stiffened their resolve.
At about 6:45, a note was brought in for Mrs. Thatcher. It was from Wakeham, seeking an urgent word, because
the position had got very much worse than he'd thought.
Then she made room for Alan Clark, who, though not a cabinet minister, had managed to insert himself.
You should stay in the ballot and fight on. I do not believe you can win, but what a way to go. Unbeaten in 3 elections, never rejected by the people, brought down by non-entities.
Clark was hastened out of the room, and Wakeham and Kenneth Baker entered. They told her that most of the cabinet now thought that she should stand down. And Wakeham's only new piece of information was that Tristan Garrell-Jones and Richard Ryder had refused to help with her campaign,
as they did not believe she could succeed.
This was a substantial blow. Ryder had allegedly said,
I would lose my political credibility if I attached myself to such a hopeless cause.
Mrs. Thatcher continued her sad encounters. Norman Lamont told her,
the position is beyond repair.
By 7:45 it was clear that 12 cabinet ministers thought she could not win. Although Hurd and Major had promised to sign Mrs. Thatcher's nomination papers, they too thought she should not go on. Neither said this to her. Contrary to what was afterwards said, no cabinet minister told Mrs. Thatcher that he would resign if she did not. Many of them told her they did not want to see her humiliated. In the view of her principal private secretary, Andrew Turnbull, who noted her meetings with ministers,
when they said, we don't want to see you humiliated, what they meant was, if you don't stand aside, we can't come in and stand against Heseltine.
Outside Mrs. Thatcher's room, like schoolboys outside the head's study, cabinet ministers compared accounts of their ordeals.
How many did you get?
One asked another, meaning how many strokes of the cane.
There was Chris Patton,
recalled David Waddington, the Home Secretary, and a Thatcher supporter.
Rubbing his bottom and saying, she gave me a good whacking. I could have killed the bloody man.
Wakeham returned to Mrs. Thatcher's room in Parliament. He told her,
the true feelings of the Cabinet had not been brought out at that meeting at lunchtime, and I discovered the depth of the problem only when I sought and failed to recruit the campaign team.
This was the coup de grace. Mrs. Thatcher summed up her reaction. It was the end. I was sick at heart. What grieved me was the desertion of those I had always considered friends and allies, and the weasel words whereby they transmuted their betrayal into frank advice and concern for my fate. The atmosphere that night was like the 3 witches in Macbeth. The witchery, she mistakenly thought, was Heseltine's.
By now,
as Turnbull's record put it,
the Prime Minister realised it was unlikely that she would be able to continue. She said she would return to No. 10 to talk to Mr. Thatcher before taking a decision.
Mrs. Thatcher got back to Downing Street at 8:10. She went up to the flat to talk to Dennis. There was not much to say, she recorded, but he comforted me. He had given his own verdict earlier, and it had turned out to be right. This was probably the moment in which she really decided that she would resign. Even so, she kept to her usual rule and said that she would sleep on it. Andrew Turnbull took advantage of her absence upstairs to warn Sir Robert Fellowes, the Queen's private secretary, to prepare for her resignation the following day. At 8:30 that evening, Goodlad and Ken Clark fished out Douglas Hurd from a Commons dinner of businessmen. Both men were supporters of a Hurd leadership bid, although, as a whip, Goodlad was not supposed to have a view. They wanted Hurd to say that he would stand with Major in the second ballot. Hurd wanted Major's agreement. Goodlad called Major in Huntingdon, and Major told him he was content.
At this period, no drama in the Conservative Party was complete without the presence of Geoffrey Archer, the ex-MP and best-selling thriller writer who lived in hope of a peerage from whoever was Tory Prime Minister. Because the leadership contest was a party matter, not a government one, Andrew Turnbull forbade the use of a government car to take Mrs. Thatcher's nomination papers to John Major. Geoffrey Archer offered his own.
In the phone call with Goodlad, Major pointed out that he was expecting Geoffrey Archer's car with Mrs. Thatcher's nomination papers for his signature. He warned that there were journalists waiting at his door who'd been tipped off by the Prime Minister's campaign team. Goodlad advised Major to send the driver away to a nearby hotel to await instructions. At 9:30 or so, Hurd told Goodlad he agreed to stand, with Major also standing, but not if Mrs. Thatcher was still in the race. In other words, she must go. He wanted a public statement that his contest with Major would be
conducted on a wholly friendly basis to give colleagues a choice.
Renton and Goodlad then rang Major, who agreed.
The die,
wrote Goodlad,
was now cast.
Major, however, was still fretting about the nomination papers. Returning them, signed, to Downing Street was dangerous because, as Tim Renton put it,
a very conspiratorial worry arises.
Having once received Major's signed paper, the Thatcher team might decide to use it.
If it falls into the hands of her press secretary,
Renton asked his diary,
could he lodge it with those in charge of the vote tomorrow morning?
Could she suddenly pull off a coup against the coup? Peter Morrison scribbled a note to Andrew Turnbull.
Between you and me, John Major is now jibbing at seconding the nomination.
On this note, Turnbull wrote,
because he's been offered a glimpse of his own candidacy.
Effectively, Major was telling Morrison that he would nominate Mrs. Thatcher for the second ballot only if he knew she would not actually stand in it. By now, a cabinet meeting had been arranged for 9 a.m. the next day. To allay Major's fear, Renton and Goodlad recommended he send the signed nomination papers back in Archer's car, but with a covering letter requesting that the papers not be submitted until after cabinet. This would allow him to recover them should circumstances arise.
Which might lead him to stand himself.
Goodlad had asked Peter Morrison to
give his word of honour that he would abide by such arrangements and not release the nomination papers without John Major's consent.
This Morrison did. At about 10:30, Morrison privately confirmed to Major on the telephone that Mrs. Thatcher would not stand in the second ballot. Reassured, Major sent Archer's driver back to London bearing Mrs. Thatcher's nomination papers signed by him. The driver also took away Major's papers for his own entry into the contest, typed up by his wife Norma. With this nomination, Major enclosed two handwritten letters, both to Morrison. The first said,
Dear Peter, the following is for your eyes only. I gather there is a possibility of resignations from the Cabinet if the PM proceeds against the wishes of colleagues. This would obviously be awful for the PM and the party. Could you please hold the nomination until after Cabinet? Refer to me if such a problem arises. I am anxious to protect the PM from any further unpleasantness wherever possible, and also protect the party. Yours ever, John.
Thus did Major artfully set out to Morrison what had been earlier agreed with him on the telephone, without committing anything to paper, which could prove their agreement had been made. He presented his wishes in terms of the welfare of others. Major's second letter to Morrison concerned his own application to contest the leadership.
I haven't enclosed a consent form for me, but will reflect later this evening. I may then send one, but it merits some thought first, I think. Keep in touch.
In fact, he had sent his consent form so that it could be ready, without any interference from Morrison, for delivery the following morning. In these two envelopes, Mrs. Thatcher's fate was almost literally sealed. John Major's entry into the contest, on highly favourable terms, was sealed too. Before turning in, Renton and Goodlad had a final talk with Morrison. Morrison recognised that a second ballot could only lead to humiliation and division.
A field marshal cannot run a war if the generals do not want to fight.
He was quoting the phrase that Mrs. Thatcher had used to him. At home, Geoffrey Archer received from his driver the envelope containing Major's nomination of Mrs. Thatcher. He took it round to Downing Street himself to put it into the hand of Morrison. It was 1:30 a.m. Archer detected from Morrison's absolute lack of interest in the form that it was not going to be used. Morrison noticed that the envelope given to him by the nosy writer of fiction was
damp and looked as if it had been steamed open.
Thursday, the 22nd of November. In the morning, a Tory backbencher, Michael Brown, was woken by the doorbell of his flat in Pimlico. It was his fellow Thatcherite, Edward Lee.
"We've got to go to number 10 now,"
said Lee.
"The Cabinet is meeting at 9. We've got to stop them. Bring her canvass lists. We must say, you can win."
The two young believers set off, Brown unshaven, and reached Downing Street at 6:30. It was an entirely forlorn hope. Mrs. Thatcher could not see them. All they could do was watch from the small waiting room. At 8, they saw Peter Morrison pass by. Brown rushed up and grabbed him by the lapels.
"You stupid, stupid idiot,"
he shouted as Morrison went puce.
"Go and tell her she can win."
He did not. Indeed, by then he could not, since at 7:30 Mrs. Thatcher had summoned him up to the flat to tell him she would resign. At 9, Andrew Turnbull walked her down the stairs to the Cabinet room. Normally, he recorded, ministers would be
milling around in the anteroom, and there's a hubbub of conversation.
But
as she came down the stairs, no one could be seen, and there was no noise. For a minute it seemed as if the meeting might have been arranged for the wrong time. Then, as she passed the Macmillan portrait, one could see the Cabinet standing silently, pushed back against the walls of the anteroom, trying to look as invisible as possible. By then, they had realised the full significance of what was about to happen. The Cabinet then filed slowly and sheepishly into the Cabinet room.
Mrs. Thatcher sat down, flanked by her closest ally, Cecil Parkinson, and her Lord Chancellor, Lord Mackay.
Lord Mackay was the first Lord Chancellor ever to come from the Scottish legal system. His role that day arose from the protocol, which made the Lord Chancellor the senior cabinet minister after the Prime Minister.
She read out the first words of her statement, but then almost broke down and was momentarily unable to speak. Parkinson, trying to help, put his hand on her arm and said,
"The Lord Chancellor will read it for her." "No, the Lord Chancellor won't,"
replied Mackay.
"She'll deal with it herself. I felt she'd regret it all her life if she didn't do it herself,"
he recalled.
She got immediate strength.
Thus fortified, Mrs. Thatcher read out, "Having consulted widely among colleagues, I have concluded that the unity of the party and the prospect of victory in a general election would be better served if I stood down to enable Cabinet colleagues to enter the ballot for the leadership. I should like to thank all those colleagues in Cabinet and outside who have given me such dedicated support." As she had broken down, so had others. Tim Renton noticed David Waddington
sitting opposite her openly in tears.
Caroline Slocock, the Prime Minister's only woman private secretary, was not much in sympathy with Mrs. Thatcher's politics, but found herself weeping as she sat against the wall of the Cabinet room. "It was like watching Mary, Queen of Scots, being beheaded. I had tears streaming and no means of capturing them." She was forced to borrow Waddington's handkerchief.
"Crocodiles, mostly,"
recalled Chris Patton of his colleagues' tears.
"The majority of us just stared at the table."
Tim Renton, though no friend to Mrs. Thatcher, was impressed by her
fighting spirit. These are the dying agonies,
he wrote in his diary.
But at some stage in the cabinet, it is all quiet and uncomfortable. She comments that with three more supporters, she would have won, and she would not now be withdrawing. That's an extraordinary thought.
Renton was one of those who had withheld his backing. Formal proceedings were over by 10:15, but Mrs. Thatcher invited ministers to stay for coffee. Ken Baker said,
the story will be that the cabinet split and forced you out.
Mrs. Thatcher immediately replied, but that's true. That's why the advice changed between lunchtime and 6 p.m. Some were extremely anxious to leave and run the campaigns for Hurd or for Major. Major was the only important minister not present. He was driving from the country with toothache and a campaign to launch at noon. His supporters scampered to the Treasury, where they joined quite a crowd to welcome their candidate.
I was astounded,
wrote Major.
I had no idea I was likely to find such strong backing so quickly.
He cannot in reality have been so surprised.
In the ensuing three-way contest for the second ballot between Heseltine, Hurd and Major, Mrs. Thatcher gave Major her support. She was persuaded she must do this to stop Heseltine. Major therefore won the vote on Tuesday the 27th of November 1990. 56 voted for Hurd, 131 for Heseltine and 185 for Major. Heseltine and Hurd withdrew. Major became Prime Minister the next day. Mrs. Thatcher left 10 Downing Street for the last time as Prime Minister just after 9 a.m. on Wednesday, the 28th of November.
Earlier that morning, Paul Allen, Mrs. Thatcher's long-serving hairdresser, had a 7:45 appointment with her at 10 Downing Street to make her look her best for her last day in office. As he crossed St. James's Park, he realised that he'd forgotten his cutting and styling comb. It was too late to return to his salon, and so he hurried into number 10 and asked if anyone around at that hour had such a thing. No one did.
I couldn't ask her,
he felt, on this day of all days. The only thing was to go up to the Thatcher's flat and extract a spare comb, which was normally kept on the dressing table in her bedroom. The flat was, as usual, open. Alan crept upstairs and knocked softly on every door, lest the Prime Minister should be behind it. She was not. He took the comb, fled downstairs and arrived just in time to give Mrs. Thatcher his full attention.
It was the best I ever did her hair,
he recalled. Thus elegantly coiffed and looking immaculate in a burgundy suit, Mrs. Thatcher descended to the entrance hall with Dennis at 9 o'clock. She found it crowded with all the staff waiting to say goodbye to her, including Amanda Ponsonby, her friend and diary secretary. That's what brought her to tears, recalled Amanda. Everyone clapped her, and as she approached the front door, she had to stop and dab her eyes. Then she emerged into the street with Dennis beside her. After she got into the waiting car, the camera caught the tear in Mrs. Thatcher's eye. The car proceeded to Buckingham Palace. The Thatchers were accompanied by her personal protection officer, Barry Strevens. It was, he remembered,
the quietest journey I've ever done.
Dennis, untypically, was holding her hand. As they approached the palace, he muttered,
steady the buffs.
As always in an audience, the Prime Minister saw the Queen alone, this time to say farewell. Robert Fellows, the Queen's private secretary, prepared Mrs. Thatcher by telling her that she was about to be offered the Order of Merit. She was surprised and delighted. It had been the Queen's personal suggestion. The audience finished after 20 minutes, and then the Queen said goodbye to Dennis as well. The couple, so downcast before, looked better as they emerged. Shortly after the Thatchers left, John Major arrived to kiss hands. Mrs. Thatcher was no longer Prime Minister. She was driven to a house in Great College Street where her closest aides were gathered. A nervous secretary noticed that there was nothing for her to do. Can I get you a cup of coffee, Prime Mrs. Thatcher? She said. Later, Amanda Ponsonby accompanied the Thatchers to their house in Dulwich. There was no food. She and I sat in the kitchen. She was completely broken.
These are Mrs. Thatcher's last words in office.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're leaving Downing Street for the last time after 11 and a half wonderful years, and we're very happy that we leave the United Kingdom in a very, very much better state than when we came here 11 and a half years ago. It's been a tremendous privilege to serve this country as Prime Minister. Wonderfully happy years. Now it's time for a new chapter to open, and I wish John Major all the luck in the world. He'll be splendidly served, and he has the makings of a great Prime Minister, which I'm sure he'll be in very short time. Thank you very much. Goodbye.